For the week of April 11th, 2010, this is Showbiz Sandbox Episode 49, the podcast that brings you all the dirt on the news making headlines around the entertainment world. In Los Angeles, I'm Jay Sperling Reich.
And in Los Angeles, I'm Karen Woodward.
And at a McDonald's in beautiful downtown Brentwood, Pennsylvania, I'm Michael Gills.
You're at a McDonald's, you know, you're not really supposed to be eating that stuff.
I know, supersize me, baby. I'm already supersized, but I'm here because for the Wi-Fi.
Now, you're headed to Nashville, so thank you for stopping to participate in this week's podcast. We'll have Steve Zajcik from the Los Angeles Times on a little later to talk about the sequel mentality that's run amok here in Hollywood. And we also have some late-breaking news about Conan O'Brien. We've got a ton of news to talk about this week. And just before we start, I want to thank all of our listeners because I received dozens and dozens and dozens of emails telling me that I misspelled Justin Bieber's name in the headline for last week's podcast. So,
oh, baby.
Yes, well, thank you. It was actually a test. I just wanted to see if any of our listeners were paying attention, and apparently they were. So before we drag my apology out too long, I should probably turn it over to you, Michael, to tell us about the North American box office.
Absolutely. The queen of television, Tina Fey, is now the queen of the movies because her film, Date Night with Steve Carell of The Office, is the number one film in America. It opened at $27.1 million, just beating out week two of Clash of the Titans, which fell 56% and is falling hard, which made $26.8 million. At number three, the biggest success story of the last few weeks, How to Train Your Dragon, which after a modest opening but great reviews and great word of mouth, is now holding really steady, 12.6% drop, $25 million for the weekend, $133 million total. It should make $200 million in the U.S. and at least that around the world. So a movie that looked like it might possibly not be a hit is definitely turned into one. And that's why you should never, you know, throw in the towel after the first weekend. You know, you always, people go too crazy over opening weekends. You got to look at the long term. At number four is Tyler Perry's Why Did I Get Married 2, which dropped. His movies always drop, but this dropped 62.4% in its second weekend, which is a record for Tyler Perry. It grossed $11 million, but it's made $48 million, and it cost $20 million to make, so that's a hit.
Yeah, that's not the kind of record you really want to be setting.
No. Tyler Perry is fine. He has money in the bank, baby. Don't worry about him. If you make triple your box out, your budget, you're fine every time. And at number five is the Miley Cyrus film, The Last Song, which made $10 million and is at $42 million total. And again, it cost $20 million to make. And number 6 through 10 is some holdovers like Alice in Wonderland, which is getting near $800 million worldwide. Hot Tub Time Machine, which has just equaled its budget. It's now made $36 million total. The Bounty Hunter, Letters to God, an evangelical Christian film. And the big success down there, Diary of a Wimpy Kid, which has now made $53 million. And again, it costs $50 million to make. So that's a huge hit.
Yeah, it's interesting because these days, of course, Hollywood is really going after big blockbuster franchise, tentpole, I'm seeing how many buzzwords I can throw into this sentence. They're going for big budget movies that have kind of an automatic audience, and yet all of these $15, $20 million movies are actually making money.
Hello, April.
You know, Michael, I think that that's the Miley Cyrus song playing in the background at McDonald's from the last song.
Is it really?
I think so.
You may be right. That's a tie-in. That's a tie-in if I've ever heard it.
I don't know what we're tying in, but hopefully we won't have to pay licensing fees. I guess, really, I don't know if we have anything more to say about the box office other than...
Did anybody go to the movies this weekend?
I did not.
Karen?
No, I threw out my back, so it was all I could do to sit in a chair.
Oh, you poor thing. I'm sorry.
Old.
Well, technically, if you were at the movies, you would have been sitting in a chair.
No, I couldn't sit in a chair. That took too much effort.
Ah, okay.
Never mind. I was laying on my back all weekend. Okay.
I don't know if you actually meant to say it that way, but, you know, last weekend you saw The Runaways, and it's earned $2.5 million to date in 24 days, which Box Office Mojo says makes it the least seen music bio on record. So it's the least attended music biography.
Yeah. That's silly. It's not true. And the movie's not done grossing money yet. And I'm sure there's those films about Edith Piaf didn't all make lots of money. I mean, there's certainly biopics. There's some, you know, movie biopic about Chopin that didn't make a lot of money. You know, that's just they're just being petty.
Well,
and it's not even out of the theaters yet. You know, it's chugging along. It's not a success story. There's no question about it. But there's plenty of biopics from around the world about music figures that have made less money.
Well, now, speaking of the number of attendees at movies, Date Night, which barely edged out Clash of the Titans for the number one spot, I think there was about $200,000 or $300,000 difference between the two grosses. And those, of course, are studio estimates, so that could shake out, and Clash of the Titans may have wound up in first place by Tuesday. We'll find out. But more people saw Date Night than saw Clash of the Titans, because Date Night did not have the $5 surcharge for 3D.
Didn't we talk about this last week?
It's not a $5 surcharge everywhere. It depends what city you're in and what you know, screening in the day you go to. But yeah, they're charging a higher ticket price for Clash of the Titans and How to Train Your Dragon. But, you know, that's okay. Long Hollywood history of charging extra for big movies.
Well, I wonder if they're going to make a sequel to Date Night. And we'll have to ask Steve Zajcik when we get him on. But why don't we talk about some of the other big news while we wait for Steve Zajcik to call in.
Can I go first?
Sure, why not?
Just as Showbiz Sandbox went to press, big news just broke that Conan O'Brien is going to TBS. Everybody kept talking about Fox or maybe ABC, but it's TBS, the cable channel. Basic cable, no less. He starts in November. His show will air at 11 p.m. George Lopez, who's been doing well, he's been hitting over 1 million people, which is a good number for TBS. He moves to midnight, and in a release accompanying the announcement, Conan O'Brien said, "In 3 months, I've gone from network television to Twitter to performing lives in theater, and now I'm headed to basic cable. My plan is working perfectly." And that's Titanic news. It says a lot about the money available in basic cable and the fit and what it means. And, you know, what do you guys think? Does this look good or bad for Conan, or is this a smart move by TBS? Talk to me.
I think it's a smart move on Conan's part for a couple of reasons. One, because there were a lot of moving parts with Fox in terms of the O&Os and, you know, when they were going to be on the air, fighting the profitable syndication that a lot of the Fox affiliates want to play at 11 o'clock and 11:30. Sorry, at 11:30. So there was or 11 o'clock? Sorry.
11 o'clock. Plus, yeah, they have that hour of local news, which is also kind of a bummer.
Yeah. So while Fox kind of seemed to be the obvious choice, TBS, from what I understand, really wooed him hard. And to me, it gives him, you know, better options in terms of time slots and creativity. But what I also think is interesting is that by being on TBS, he has less pressure to bring in the big numbers.
Oh, absolutely.
Yeah, I mean, the audience has become completely fractured with 500 channels. Rather than getting, you know, 5, 6, 7 million people to watch your show every night, if he gets 2 million people to watch his show every night, that's a success.
Yeah, so there's a lot less pressure there.
He was getting 2 million at NBC.
Right. But he's also going up against Jay Leno and David
Letterman.
Only
in the second half hour. Yep, but he's got a half hour all to himself. And George Lopez
is up against The Daily Show.
Yeah, he's going up against The Daily Show.
Not in all markets, though.
Yeah, no, I mean, that's the whole deal. But, you know, A, he's not really going up against anyone. Everyone has a DVR. It gives him freedom, probably a lot of money. And if it scores big, he can make a ton of money, I bet. I'm sure the deal is a rich one. It's not syndication, but it's TBS. And, you know, there's money to be made. And I'm sure they ponied up for him. And it makes them look good. I think it's a good low-risk move for him. I don't think you can say there's anything like low rent or, you know, cheap about basic cable. You've got two of the best shows on TV, Mad Men and Breaking Bad are on AMC. You've got, you know, there's just so many shows on so many channels that as long as your show's good, people will come to it. It doesn't matter what channel.
Also, he owns this show. He was not going to have that opportunity at Fox.
When you say he owns the show, meaning, why don't you explain what that means?
Well, I mean, he certainly gets more profit participation being an owner of the show. He also gets more of a say in terms of, you know, what goes into it. He owns the show. Like David Letterman owns his show and owns Craig Ferguson's show.
Right. So he's acting both as on-air talent and, of course, as a producer.
Exactly.
I mean, it'll be interesting to see what happens. Of course, if he fails, it's going to be a bit of an issue.
But it would be a bigger failure if he failed on Fox.
That's a good point. He kind of failed on NBC. In most ways, you slice it. He didn't get enough time, blah, blah, blah. Nonetheless, he wasn't a big success out of the bat. So you're right. He would have had one more big chance to. You can't fail on TBS. He will get 2 million viewers, at least to start. And, you know, people like him, so it'll be all right.
Well, let's not forget that some of the most watched talk shows are on the Comedy Central of all networks. So,
well, they reach a million. They reach a million people a night.
Right. So, and they're kind of widely talked about and kind of seen as trendsetters. So isn't this stigma to basic cable or even cable networks as there used to be.
And let's not forget that a podcast shakes the entertainment world every week. So it doesn't matter what format you're in.
He's also going to be he's leading into George Lopez, and he'll probably be following stuff like Family Guy, My Name is Earl, and kind of, you know, subversive comedies like that, that are really much better suited to him.
Much better than an hour of the local news, that's for sure.
Yeah.
Well, it'll be interesting to see what he puts together. I guess he's doing it from Los Angeles since he just moved his entire crew and personnel out there.
Yeah, that's my understanding too.
Or I don't know, is TBS in Atlanta?
Yeah,
Maybe they'll be moving again.
Yeah, I doubt they're doing the show from Atlanta.
I would not imagine not. I don't know where George Lopez is filmed.
L.A.
Okay.
Well, why don't we switch things up a little bit and talk about some other TV news first before we maybe head back to movies when Steve Zajcik calls us. Somebody else announcing some plans was Oprah Winfrey. She's announcing, she announced 5 shows at the Discovery Communications Upfronts. So she is, of course, announcing these shows for the Oprah Winfrey Network, or OWN. Well, Michael, do you want to fill us in on what she said?
She said, you mean some of her plans include 5 different shows that she talked about. Oprah will be featured in 2 of them. Oprah's next chapter is described as part travelogue and part interview show. Oprah won't be tied down to those chairs anymore, which apparently was a burden. Now she'll go around the world and talk to famous people and visit the Taj Mahal and the Great Wall of China and stuff like that. She's going to have a reality competition show searching for the next breakout TV talk show host. That's going to be hosted by her pal, Gail King, and it's called Your Own Show, Oprah's Search for the Next TV Star. It's
also Life Must Be Good as Gail King. I mean, she doesn't have to do anything.
And it's produced by Mark Burnett, of course, who did Survivor and The Apprentice. There's also Gail King Live, which is a video feed of the radio show that Gail King hosts on the Oprah channel on the Sirius Satellite Radio. Then there's Behind the Scenes, the Oprah Show final season, which chronicles the final months of her show, which apparently will not be a long-running series. Visionaries, Inside the Creative Mind, which takes a look at the creative process with people like James Cameron, Annie Leibovitz, Tom Ford, Lady Gaga, and myself, I imagine. I'm not sure about that. That's not confirmed yet.
definitely you.
Well, and apparently they actually need a show like this because they named the network the Oprah Winfrey Network, probably the least creative name I've ever heard.
but she owns it. And then finally there's Why Not with Shania Twain, a chronicle of the country music star's effort to rebuild her career after personal setbacks and the end of her 14-year marriage, to her Svengali, who made her the massive star that she is, I might add. But there you go.
That seems like a really weird show. Don't you think that seems like a weird choice for Shania Twain to do that?
Why not?
No, it's free publicity. She's a big, 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 big star. I mean, she sold a ton of albums for a while, so a lot of people are interested in Why Not. It's easier than giving interviews.
I'm not saying that it's not going to get people to watch it. I just think it's an interesting choice on her part to do that. Because, she's a big star. She doesn't necessarily have to do that.
It's such a safe venue, though. I'm sure it'll be good and rebuild attention for her. And you see stuff like that on country music television all the time, CMT. So I think it's a smart move. I think it'll be done in a classy style. If it was on, TLC or something, I might think, But,
yes.
It's connected to Oprah, so it's pretty smart.
You know, what I think is funny is that, somebody probably called her up and said, hey, you want to do this show on the Oprah Winfrey Network? And she probably said, why not? And sure enough, that's the name of the show.
I know, I'll bet you're right. Sadly, that's probably exactly what happened.
Yeah, I'm telling you, the least creative network. It's named the Oprah Winfrey Network, and now they've just named the show with probably the first word Shania Twain said after being offered a show.
My show will be called, yeah.
And now it's a censorable show.
Well, do any of these shows excite you at all?
Not in the least. It's all routine, pedestrian, basic cable stuff. Nothing's interesting or smart or different or exciting.
Yeah, for the most part, I agree. Is there stuff that I would actually watch? Yeah, I actually think it'd be sort of interesting to see the behind-the-scenes stuff, the Oprah show final season. I'm sort of a sucker for that.
Yeah, that's got to be just a short run thing, though. They can't do 2 years of that. And then I'm sure everybody will watch Oprah's next chapter, her, doing what she does. But you know, on a less regular basis.
Right, and that's going to be on, again, cable, not on a broadcast network. So there's another big name headed over to cable.
But when you can buy a cable channel, it's quite different than just appearing on one.
Yeah, true. You know, maybe we should have segued from Conan O'Brien into this little incident that happened on The Tonight Show with Jay Leno. Slash has this new record coming out, and he, of course, he's the former guitarist for Guns N' Roses. And he...
And the current guitarist for Velvet Revolver.
Okay, thank you.
Thank you very much.
But he has a new solo album, and he was on The Tonight Show to promote it. And he came out and performed wearing a little pin that said, "I'm with Coco." I guess he wanted to let everybody know he's really on Conan O'Brien's side, even though he's performing on The Tonight Show. And so NBC had to cut around it and had to edit around it, and it was just very awkward because, you know, here it's Slash is the main act, and they can't do a close-up, they can't, you know, cut to his guitar because the pin was right by his guitar, so they had all these medium shots and long shots. It was very funny.
Well, I don't know whether that's punk or whether it's just obnoxious.
Obnoxious?
Yeah, going on the Jay Leno show and wearing "I Like Conan," that's obnoxious.
I think it's awesome. But then that's totally something I would do, so on all my Tonight Show appearances.
Well, now, what do you think of the whole Tiger Woods Nike commercial?
I thought it was brilliant.
I thought it was brilliant, too. Kyle Koster of the Chicago Sun-Times says it just doesn't do it, kind of playing off of Nike's tagline there. And it was just in time for the Masters Golf Tournament. It started airing Wednesday, and Nike released it to it's a black and white ad with Tiger Woods looking into the camera stoically, and it kind of dollies into him and zooms into his face just very slowly, and the voice of his late father Earl talks about responsibility. And I think that's where he got a lot of flack, was putting the voice of his late father in there. And I'm going to see if I can pull it up on YouTube.
Well, especially because you know that his dad was not talking about this.
No, his father passed away, I think, 2 or 3 years ago.
Yeah, so you know that the dad wasn't calling him out on his recent behavior. So that was definitely a weird disconnect. But it was a pretty brilliant move, I thought, in terms of, and ballsy of Nike to do that. And it worked. I mean, I don't think it makes Tiger Woods anything less of a scumbag, but it worked.
Well, Kyle Koster wrote in the Chicago Sun-Times that the spot insults our intelligence, and I'm quoting here, "If you're truly trying to be repentant and change, wouldn't you do it more quietly, not in front of millions of TV viewers, using your dead father's voiceover in a commercial peddling your product? It does seem that Woods is trying to have it both ways. When news of his infidelity surfaced, he chastised the media for being too involved in his personal affairs. Now, he and Nike have teamed to address the very issue he wanted so very much to keep under wraps."
Yeah, well, if you can't beat him, join him.
So a man with 27 mistresses is trying to have it both ways? Really?
I agree with Kyle Koster saying that because of all this commotion that the commercial has caused, it's actually quite effective. It might be seen as a success.
Oh, there's no question it's a success.
Well, another big success is Usher. He overtook Justin Bieber, spelled B-I-E-B-E-R, not B-E-I-B-E-R, in case...
I before E, Sperling.
Yes, yeah, thanks. best part is, by the way, that I sent that link to Dig, and I had to contact them via email to change the headline, and they did. So anyway, Usher overtook Justin Bieber in the top spot on Billboard's Top 200 chart, and his new album, Raymond vs. Raymond, is his third straight album to go straight to number one. It sold 329,000 copies in its first week, and it bumped Justin Bieber down. His album, My World 2.0, is now number 2.0 on the chart.
How could he do that to his protege?
Hey, man, he's showing who's the boss.
That's right. Usher's still the boss. Usher, of course, has taken Justin Bieber under his wing, and I guess he's showing him how it's really done. Even though Justin Bieber's album actually had a little sales uptick of 3%.
Yeah, in many weeks, 291,000 would keep him at number one. But he was on Saturday Night Live. He performed twice and performed in skits with Tina Fey. So Justin Bieber's having a good couple weeks.
I'd say so, although I guess there was a big expose in the Los Angeles Times on him. about, you know, what it's really like behind the scenes with his entourage and...
And his swagger coach.
And his swagger coach, who bristles at being called a swagger coach. I thought that was kind of funny. Bristles. And, you know, and he bought a Range Rover, and they didn't want the name of the car in the article, which I thought was... I don't get why.
Well, he mentioned it on Jay Leno, so I don't know why it would be a big deal.
Yeah, they were trying to, like, you know, hush it up after that.
It was on television, network television.
Yeah, I don't know why the publicist was so up in arms about that, but apparently, according to the Los Angeles Times, the publicist for the label and his personal publicist was trying to, you know, squelch that. And he,
probably because she's getting kickbacks from, you know, Mini Cooper or something. She just
no, she's just trying to look like she's doing a job. They always, publicists always try to interfere and do stupid stuff that the star doesn't care about and isn't bad for them. They just try to look busy because 90% of the time they have nothing to do. What do you do with Justin Bieber? You sit and take messages. Everybody wants to interview him, okay? Which one do you want to do, Justin?
Yeah, you say no a lot is basically what you do.
Right.
Incoming phone call business.
I wonder if he gets any requests via Twitter.
Nice little plug there for our next story about Jim Carrey and Jenny McCarthy, who broke up. They didn't break up via Twitter, but they let their fans know via Twitter. I guess it was last week sometime that Jenny McCarthy sent out on her Twitter account, 3 p.m. Tuesday, she wrote, "I'm so grateful for the years Jim and I had together. I will stay committed to Jane and will always keep Jim as a leading man in my heart." And of course, Jane is Jim Carrey's 22-year-old daughter who had a baby in February. And around the same time, around 3 p.m. last Tuesday, Jim Carrey himself wrote on his Twitter account, "Jenny and I have just ended our 5-year relationship. I'm grateful for the many blessings we've shared, and I wish her the very best. So-kay." And he had a, like a little wink, like a little smiley face wink in the tweet.
Actually, I don't know what that is. It's a series of symbols.
Yes.
A smile. If you turn it upside down, you can see it's a full face.
Yeah.
If you look at it sideways, it's a full face looking in one direction with a
smile.
Oh,
how cute is that?
Yeah. So, Karen, what do you think about people synchronizing their Twitter announcements of breakup or getting together and all this? Is it something you have to do? Is it smart to do?
I think it's very smart to do. If you want to own – well, when you're Jenny McCarthy and you're Jim Carrey, you already know how everything works. You don't need anybody to guide you through the entertainment business. They know how it works. So when you're at that level, this is absolutely what you can and should do. Sure, why not? Good for them.
Well, you know, somebody else got into some trouble for tweeting. I mean, that whole Jim Carrey, Jenny McCarthy thing seemed like it was orchestrated by a publicist. Something that wasn't orchestrated by a publicist was the fact that...
Oh, whoa. I wouldn't say of course to that. Jim Carrey is very active on Twitter, and it would not surprise me if he's just suggested to Jenny, who's also pretty active on Twitter, that they do it that way. My experience has been that most publicists avoid social media. They don't understand how to use it in a strategic way. So I would guess this came from them.
Well, something that definitely came from Jon Favreau and not the publicist was the fact that Harrison Ford will be joining his next movie, Cowboys and Aliens. Last Wednesday, he announced via Twitter... He wrote, "Please stop asking if Harrison Ford is in Cowboys and Aliens, okay? He is. Please don't tell anybody." And apparently, The Hollywood Reporter is suggesting that Favreau, quote, "took DreamWorks execs as well as Ford's agency by surprise." And they went on to say that he'd been chastised before when working on Iron Man 2 for tweeting certain things, and they told him to kind of calm down with that. And so I think it's interesting. Ann Thompson of IndieWire... wrote, "How coolly efficient to learn that the news direct from the source rather than through a studio press release. Who needs the trades anyway? My job as a trade blogger is to pass it on to whoever may have missed it." I think that's very true. What do you guys think?
I like that slap on Variety and Hollywood Reporter. Thanks, Ann Thompson.
I think this is why we have social media, so that Jon Favreau can tweet things like this. And, you know, I followed him while he was covering Iron Man 2. He never said anything that was really horrible. He did just enough to tease, and that's what you're supposed to do.
Yeah, this studio is stupid. They should be thrilled that he was doing it. Half the time they're trying to put in your contract and make you do it. The other half of the time they're freaking out. They don't know what to do.
They don't understand it. You know, the entertainment business is so far behind social media that it's mind-boggling.
Well, why don't we get somebody from the mainstream media, Steve Zaitchek, to tell us what's going on in movies, at least when it comes to sequels. I'm going to add him here to our conference.
Steve Zeitchi.
Steve, this is Sperling, and I have Karen and Michael with me.
Great. Hey, Sperling. Hey, guys.
Hey there.
How you doing?
Good. We just wanted to talk to you really quickly about your wonderful post or article. I don't know. Do you guys still call them articles or posts in the newsroom?
We call them a little bit of both. I usually just say item.
Item. Okay. Yeah. Well, okay. That's a good word. Your item, premature sequelization, sequel culture runs amok. You're saying studios used to take years to commit to making a sequel and would rarely do so before a movie came out. What is changing that?
Well, there's a couple of things that are changing that. I think first, as you note, I mean, this phenomenon is becoming pretty pervasive as far as, you know, getting kind of sequels into development, which again mean, you know, could mean that they're, you know, a long way from actually ever seeing the screen or ever getting into production. But you're certainly seeing a lot of studios kind of gather their ducks and sort of see if they have enough for a sequel, you know, weeks, months, or in some cases, you know, many months before the film comes out. So I think what we're really starting to see is a sea change as far as how studios think about sequels. As far as how or why this is happening, I think you've got a couple of things going on. First off, you know, development is trickier than ever. It's harder than ever to get movies made. If you're an executive who's trying to get a movie pushed forward, it's, as your listeners well know, you know, there's a lot of tricks you can use. Remakes has been kind of one of the chief tactics that a studio executive or a younger executive uses to get their film kind of pushed through the pipeline. And sequels are now kind of the latest way to do that, where you say, look, we've already got a movie like The Hangover coming up, or we've got Diary of a Wimpy Kid, or we've got, you know, any one of a number of popular movies that have had sequels put into development before the movie even comes out. Let's think about developing this. And more often than not, these days, it seems like they move forward. You know, the other thing that's, of course, a factor here is time. You know, studios, given this kind of very sort of quarterly earnings focused mindset, they really want to be, you know, as quick to, you know, green light and release a sequel as they possibly can. You know, gone are the days when you've, you know, could wait 4, 5, 6 years for a second film to come out. They want to come out with it, you know, perhaps even the next year. And so if you start developing it before the movie even comes out, you give yourself a bit of a head start.
Well, now last week it was revealed that Disney has already commissioned a script for a sequel to Tron Legacy, which in itself is a sequel, and Warner Brothers is doing a sequel for Sherlock Holmes and announced that, I think, 2 months before the film came out.
Right.
The same with The Hangover, even though they didn't put an option clause in the actors' contracts and then had to go back and pay for that dearly. And you just mentioned Diary of a Wimpy Kid will also have a sequel.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, you know, you're exactly right. I mean, and the sort of breadth and depth of the examples you cite, I think, you know, kind of indicate how fundamental a trend this really is. You know, this is not just limited to, you know, a particular kind of franchise. When you think about, well, Sherlock Holmes, well, there's a lot of material you can draw from, so you would explain it that way. Diary of a Wimpy Kid, well, there's a 5-book series, so you can kind of say, all right, well, it makes sense that they'd be looking at it. But then you have examples like The Hangover, which is a totally original idea, where they didn't, you know, they knew that it was starting, I guess, to track well, or at least they knew they had a pretty good film on their hands or a pretty funny movie on their hands. But to say, all right, we could start developing a sequel, you know, months before we even know if this thing is going to be a hit. Ditto for Tron Legacy. And I think you make a good point when you say, you know, the sequels are, or remakes are themselves now spawning other sequels. And, you know, that's the culture of contemporary Hollywood, where there's a great eagerness to really push forward these movies, you know, that have a certain built-in brand recognition before you know what kind of movies they'll make, and certainly in this case, before you even know how the public is going to receive it.
Well, that's what I found interesting. I mean, as we know, Steve, Hollywood has made sequels and done series since the beginning of time, so none of this is new as such. But one thing you point out is that it can turn off fans a little bit. I mean, me, the original Tron was bad. I loved it. I liked it, but it was bad. The sequel, the remake hasn't even come out yet, and they're already talking about a sequel, and that makes me go, well, wait a second. I haven't even seen the movie. I don't know if I even like it. So I don't feel like
exactly.
I can enjoy it.
That's a really good point, and I think that's where, you know, you get kind of one of these sort of almost disparities or distinctions, if you will, between what sort of the insular and interior culture of Hollywood likes and what the larger fan base likes. I mean, certainly there are a lot of reasons to move forward on these things quickly when you're kind of in-house and working at a studio, but the message to fans often seems to be, we're going to cram this thing down your throat whether you like it or not. And bad enough, as you point out, that we're already getting these kind of remakes and reboots on movies that we didn't necessarily like that much in the first place, or if we did, movies that we don't want to see remade in the first place. And now we're getting told, you know what, you're going to like this so much. And we, I mean, in a way, it's almost a sign of their confidence in the franchise. But what it does is it seems to, at least to my mind, and it sounds like to yours as well, it's a bit of an affront in that it sort of says, you know what, we haven't really won you over yet. We haven't convinced you that this movie is going to be any good, but we're already going to give you a second helping of it. And I think it'll be interesting to see at the box office and among kind of the fans websites and among the sort of the various ways that fans chatter about these things, if they'll say, you know what, they like this a lot, so maybe we should give it a chance, but why are they so intent on pushing this on us? Let's be a little bit wary. And I think there's nothing that makes fans more wary than a studio that tells you how great the movie is. And certainly greenlighting or developing a sequel is a way of telegraphing that. So we'll see if there's a backlash.
Well, I mean, part of that, don't you think, is actually promoting the film, that if you're making a sequel, well, the first one must be great. Let's go see that one.
Right. I think that's part of it. I mean, I think in some cases, studios don't even realize it's going to get out. Things get out a lot faster and a lot more fully away than they used to. It used to be there would be rumors they were looking at it. Now we kind of know who they're hiring. So I think that yes, it does sort of have that almost unintended effect. But honestly, I don't even think studios are trying to do that. I think once they have it out there, they probably try to put a nice spin on it. You saw with The Hangover, they actually tried to retreat from it, where they said, well, we don't really have it developed yet. Holmes, they sort of went both ways. Warner Brothers did. They kind of said it wasn't really developed. It's not really being developed. We're going to wait and see. But then the Brad Pitt talk started for Moriarty for the second film, and they kind of let that one kind of go through. So I think in many cases, studios don't really know how to communicate these messages. I think you're exactly right in that it can help them market a film and show their confidence in a film. In some cases, I think they realize the hackles that can go up when these things start getting out there, and so they try to retreat from them too.
By the way, Moriarty is the evilest, smartest man in the world. I don't know if Brad Pitt is good casting, but anyway.
Well, and you raise a good point there. I mean, you know, part of the problem by getting all this word out so early is that while it could get fans enthused, it also could get them really skeptical. And when you start hearing about a sequel or hearing about people who are attached to work on these sequels, I think that, you know, again, before you've even shown people what you have, look, marketing is always about that. It's always about getting people excited about something and kind of reducing their skepticism before they have enough information to know otherwise. But in this case, I think it actually can work against them.
Yeah, and then finally, the counterexample may be something like How to Train Your Dragon, which is based on a series of books, but it came out as a movie with all the tie-ins. It had a soft opening, but it did well, got great reviews. People really like it. It's starting to build an audience. It's going to make $400 million around the world at least, if not more. And so now, if and when they announce a sequel, it'll feel very organic, and people can feel like, yeah, they earned the right to make a sequel.
Right, right. Well, and I think that's the sort of counter-argument to all of this, is that, you know, there's still kind of an old-fashioned way of doing things that is organic, or at least, look, I mean, no one's going to begrudge a studio or any corporation, any entity, from thinking about how to continually kind of mine its products. And of course, that's what these are. But at least when there's a kind of a success out in the marketplace, and How to Train Your Dragon, I think, is a perfect example of something that has built very organically and in a grassroots way, as evidenced by the soft opening weekend, but the continual, what the drop was 13% this weekend, which suggests that fans are continuing to discover it. At least when that happens, it feels like there's a give and take. And I mean, and that's really, I think, the sort of underlying message of all sequels when they're done right, is that a studio puts a movie out, the fans like it, the studios listen and say, okay, we'll give you more. And there's a kind of give and take, there's a byplay between studios and fans. And I think what's happening with Dragon, you know, is much like, is basically what used to happen, which is, you know, they listen. The studios listen to the fans. They're not just deciding and dictating. And hopefully we'll see more of those examples. That I won't be surprised if you see more of the Sherlock Holmes model as well.
Hey, Steve, I feel like this interview went really well. We should do it again next week.
Well, yeah, I'm always here for you guys. I appreciate what we do, and thanks for the intelligent questions.
I think he was joking around, but I mean, you did write
the sequel. I get it.
Yeah, the sequel. Right. To the
pretty interview. Funny. Shouldn't we have decided on that before we even sat down to do this?
We already had.
Well, you actually write the best sequels grow out of not just the original film, but the reception to it. That was a great line in your piece. Because it's true. I mean, Star Wars didn't have a sequel until everybody went to go see Star Wars.
Right. Well, and I think if you ask any writer, you know, worth his salt, they'll tell you we had to wait and see what the fans like first. So we had to at least process it ourselves. I mean, yes, there's certain, I think TV writers in particular can kind of envision a whole franchise before anything even ever comes out or hits the screen or hits the page. But I think more often than not, they want to kind of see what's working and what's not. And look, they can still do that, but it just feels like they're taking that reception into account a little bit less when they're doing it this way.
Well, certainly, we thank you for joining us to tell us about all of these sequels and what's kind of going on in the mentality of this sequel culture here in Hollywood. And Steve Zajcik, a staff writer for the Los Angeles Times, and we should probably send people to your Twitter account, which is Zajcik, L-A-T. That's Z-E-I-T-C-H-I-K-L-A-T. And, of course, that's on Twitter. Is there anything else, any other link we should be pushing or promoting or telling people?
Yeah,
about.
I appreciate the shout out, and I'm going to think of more sequel jokes I can make next time.
Thanks a lot.
Thank you very much.
Thanks a lot, guys. Really much appreciated.
And before we receive 10,000 emails, Sperling, there was, in fact, of course, Star Wars was written as one long screenplay broken up into 9 parts, and Star Wars, the first film we saw, was part 4 of 9. So, in fact, the prequels and sequels were all laid out before the first movie even got made.
Okay, I probably picked a bad example. Absolutely.
The worst in history.
The worst in history. Well,
because the fans would have pilloried us.
Well, you're saying that my mistake was a big deal, but I think it's a big whoop. Which surely brings us to our popular segment, Big Deal or Big Whoop, where we decide whether the week's top entertainment news stories are a big deal or whether anyone should care about them. Our first story is about the Producers Guild of America, which has agreed on a new credit of transmedia producer.
I, of course, added this one.
That's very interesting. I think that's a big deal. Like Karen says, it's a sign of the times and a sign that studios have to wake up and start paying attention to transmedia and all this stuff and realize how all these platforms got to work together. It's interesting.
Right. And this is basically a credit for an executive or producer who works on a project or a franchise that is distributed on multiple platforms. So it could be web, film, TV, and, you know, they're going to be referred to as transmedia producers and it will be an official credit. So Karen, you believe this is a big deal?
This is a huge deal.
And Michael?
Yeah, big deal. Getting all those parts to work together is really, really hard. It is a full-time job, so it's interesting.
Our next story is about Nicolette Sheridan, who is suing Desperate Housewives producer Mark Cherry. The former star of the ABC drama series is suing the producer for assault and wrongful termination. Apparently, she claims that he hit her, and then when she reported it to ABC executives, that she was then written out of the script and fired. Michael, is this a big deal or a big whoop?
It's a big whoop, but it's because the show is towards the end of its run, but it's kind of sad to hear about.
Karen?
It's a big whoop because, frankly, I think it's a lot of BS.
And so do her former co-stars also believe that it's a bit of a BS lawsuit. Erykah Badu, the musician and singer, was charged with disorderly conduct for her music video. Window Seat is the music video, or the song that she was doing the music video for. She was walking through Dealey Plaza, where John F. Kennedy was assassinated, and she slowly took all of her clothes off. However, the Dallas Police Department didn't issue any charges until after the video was released, which was of course, weeks if not months later, and until after, allegedly, Badu's label's PR division started pressing the police department in Dallas to press the charges because nothing screams buy my album like getting arrested. Is this a big deal or a big whoop, Karen?
Big whoop. I mean, just the fact that it took us so long to get through the explanation of that story is no one cares.
Well, that's more my fault. But Michael?
A big whoop, but she's really talented. I'm looking forward to hearing the new album.
Well, the new album debuted at number 4, having sold 110,000 copies. The title is New America, Part 2, The Return of Ankh. Our next story is about Nicolas Cage and his house, which apparently is too weird to sell. The actor has 5 loans against the house, which is a Tudor-style house in Bel Air, once owned by both Dean Martin and then later by Tom Jones. He has 5 loans totaling $35 million against it. Originally, when I worked for him, he bought it. There was only a $450,000 mortgage against it. It failed to sell at auction on Wednesday. Of course, it was foreclosed upon. And it failed to sell mainly because the interior was too weird, with elevated miniature train tracks running through several rooms and hundreds of framed comic book covers all over the house. Michael, is this a big deal or a big whoop?
It's a big whoop. Rip out the train tracks and sell the comic book covers on the web. What's the big deal?
Karen?
Yeah, big whoop. Who cares about Nicolas Cage and his real estate holdings?
Well, of course, we reported last year that he was having some financial troubles, and he is suing his former business partner for mishandling his finances. But our next story is about Brad Bird, who is in final negotiations to direct Mission Impossible 4. Now, of course, Brad Bird is the animator and filmmaker behind Ratatouille and The Incredibles, both Pixar films, but it looks like he's going to be switching over to direct live action, unless he animates Tom Cruise, which I don't think anybody would actually mind. Is this a big deal or a big whoop, Karen?
It's a big deal. Big deal for his career.
Michael?
It's a big deal for Tom Cruise's career, since Brad Bird is a terrific director. Ratatouille, The Incredibles, and The Iron Giant, he's 3 for 3. And if he does what Pixar always does, which is screenplay, 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 maybe they'll finally make a good Mission Impossible film.
Right. I mean, Pixar is very, very strict about making sure their screenplays are really locked in and make sense, and it's all about story, and everything in the film is about story. It'll be interesting to see how he transitions from animation to live action, and I certainly hope for his sake he can do it. Our next story is about Bob Dylan, who won't be playing in China. He had a couple of dates in Beijing and I think Shanghai and Hong Kong, and the Chinese government said, yeah, no, not so much. Please, don't bother. The Ministry of Culture, which vets planned concerts by overseas artists, appeared wary of Dylan's past as an icon of the counterculture movement, said Jeffrey Wu of the Taiwan-based promoter Broker's Brother Herald. Yeah, he's got a little bit of a reputation of working in the counterculture, like 40 years. So how they didn't see that coming when it was first planned, I don't know. Is this a big deal or a big whoop, Michael?
It's a big whoop, but I think it's cute that Bob Dylan is still seen as dangerous.
I'm sure he's happy about it. Karen?
You know, Bob Dylan, Google, you know, dangerous.
Yeah.
yeah, go China. No, big whoop. Nobody cares.
See, I think it's a bit of a big deal in that it's starting this whole cultural war against the West that China seems to be interested in starting. And, you know, I guess it really, Wu said that officials had become more cautious since Björk, the Icelandic singer, chanted Tibet, Tibet after performing a song called Declare Independence in Shanghai in 2008.
She's from Iceland. You can't blame... Don't blame us for Björk. And title.
Don't blame us for Björk.
That's the headline.
There's your headline. maybe. Well, that was our last story for Big Deal or Big Whoop for this week, and I guess that brings us to Inside Baseball, but I know, Karen, you have to leave us, if I'm not mistaken.
I think it's second week in a row that I miss Inside Baseball, right?
I think so. I don't think you like Hollywood. You don't really like what's going on in Hollywood, so you just leave. You know, you just want to know really the gossipy, juicy stuff, and then you're out.
Maybe. Goodbye. Next week.
Bye.
Bye. Well, Michael, that leaves just you, me, and Ronald McDonald.
He hasn't said much yet.
Well, that brings us to Inside Baseball, of course, the segment in which we discuss only the stories that Hollywood might care about. This week, we're talking about two studios that are up for sale, Miramax and MGM. Disney has been trying to sell Miramax for quite some time, and it looks as if they have a couple of bids in.
Well, yeah, they've been trying to, you know, they're flogging a dead horse here. It's got a great catalog. Other than that, I don't know if the name means much without the Weinsteins behind it. I think they've pretty much taken the value out of the name, except for the Weinsteins. So they don't deserve to get anywhere near what they've been asking.
Well, they have been asking $650 to $700 million, which it does not seem like they're going to get anywhere close to that. And to your point, Michael, the Weinsteins are actually in the running. Supermarket magnate Ron Burkle and his Yucaipa companies made a bid in association with Bob and Harvey Weinstein, who, of course, founded the company back in the late 80s and sold it to Disney in 1993. Alec and Tom Gores, who run separate investment firms, the Gores Group and Platinum Equity, also made a bid, and of course, their brothers as well. Their brother, Sam Gores, runs the Paradigm Talent Agency here in Los Angeles. And then what's interesting is David Bergstein from Pangea Media Group made a bid.
Why is that interesting?
Well, it's interesting because just last week, David Bergstein was in bankruptcy court where his creditors had taken him for allegedly mishandling finances and mismanaging finances. A federal bankruptcy judge appointed an interim trustee to oversee Bergstein as he continues to run his five companies. Apparently, what his creditors are saying is that somehow his projects never seem to make any money or never seem to get released, and that they think he's playing fast and loose with the books. So in a way, that bid for Miramax, it's a non-bid because he'll never be allowed to buy it.
Maybe he'd be better off bidding for MGM.
Well, that is if he can get it away from Tony Scott and Sir Ridley Scott. The two filmmaking brothers have an interest in running MGM, according to several sources, specifically the Financial Times. Creditors have put the beleaguered studio up for sale, of course, and it's saddled with $3.7 billion in debt. So the creditors came in and said, nope, it's ours now.
I'm sorry to ask you a question. I don't know the answer myself. It doesn't include the library, of course. The library has been sold off long ago, right? That's been parceled out for decades. At the very least, people own the rights to that stuff for a few decades, I'm sure.
I have no idea. That's a good question. I know that for years Warner Brothers owned it, and they certainly still own some titles because Ted Turner owned them. But I don't know. That's a very, very good question. We should,
because there's no value to it except for, I mean, it's nice to have the name, but it's certainly not worth that much money. You know, it's just a shingle at this point and a library, and the library is owned by other people, or at least the rights are tied up for many years. So I don't know why the Scots would want it other than the patina of calling themselves MGM. I'd call myself scot-free and be happy with it.
Well, that is the name of their current production company, the one that they make films on.
Yeah.
And of course, I don't know if I need to say this, but they're responsible for Top Gun, Gladiator, Blade Runner, Alien. I mean, if you don't know who they are at this point, you probably haven't made it to this point in the podcast. But, yeah, you know, I don't know. I'm going to actually look that up, and hopefully next week maybe one of our listeners can write in and tell us about it. dirt@showbizsandbox.com is the email address to write to us at. And if you want to call us and leave us a voicemail about it, you can do so. 888-567-SAND is the number to call. That's toll-free, 888-567-7263. You can find all of this information, of course, on our website, which is showbizsandbox.com, and that's where you'll find the show notes for episode 49, which is the episode you're listening to. Links to all of the stories we've discussed will be in the show notes. I have a little extra announcement here at the end.
Yes?
What do you think it's going to be about?
Well, it's not about MGM. It's about MGMT.
Oh, I should have segued that earlier. You're right. Yes, they are releasing their next album, congratulations, tomorrow, April 13th. And they've announced their complete world tour dates. They're going to be touring all the way through December. I'm seeing them next weekend at Coachella, the Music and Arts Festival here in Indio, California.
Awesome.
I'm really excited about it. They are, of course, have you seen their new music video for Flash Delirium?
I haven't.
It's just absolutely, it's almost impossible to describe it. It makes no sense whatsoever, and yet it's brilliant. And
that sounds intriguing.
I believe one of
you'll have to link to it in the show notes.
Yeah, we'll place a link to it in the show notes, and I believe one of the lyrics in the song says, "People say, hey, what does it mean?" And you know, yeah, what does that video mean? Doesn't really matter. It's fun to look at. If you want to hear some of their new album played live, you can do so at I guess it's Club 69 in Brussels, Belgium. We'll place a link to the tracks that they put online in the show notes. And what I thought was really silly when I was looking for that video for Flash Delirium, I went to YouTube and Sony took the video down. So it's only available on their website, which is...
There's no official video available on YouTube? That is stupid.
That is, I mean, that's where everybody goes to look for music videos. YouTube has helped bring music videos back. So I don't know what they're thinking. Anyway.
And they have a link to buy the song right there. And, you know, it's like radio on demand.
Yeah, it's so silly. But if you want to see the video, you can see it at their website, whoismgmt.com. Or, of course, you can find MGMT on MySpace. MySpace.com/MGMT is the URL to look up. Michael Giltz you can find online as well. MichaelGiltz.com is the domain to look up. He's on Twitter as well. @MichaelGiltz is the username to visit, to look up, to research. Karen Woodward is also on Twitter. Her username is @Karen_Woodward. You know, that username, we've got to talk to her about that username. It's just,
well, the other one's already taken.
Yeah, it's probably true. Karen's website is KarenWoodwardOnline.com. A website where you can find some of my writing is CelluloidJunkie.com. I'm on Twitter, @Sperling is the username to look up. And just a little bit of a programming note, if you will, because of Coachella, we will probably have to record next week's episode on Tuesday. So there will be a one-day delay in releasing next week's podcast, but hopefully we'll have some really good stuff from Coachella.
Sounds great.
All right, then. Until next week, play nice.